This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm too sexy for my shirt, too sexy for my skirt, too sexy for the other thing.
Welcome back. You're once again listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Today we're talking about episode 6 of season 3. It's called Gone Quiet.
Gone Quiet. The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin, the story by Julia Dahl and Laura Glasser, and it was directed by John Hutman. Rishi, how do we know John Hutman?
John Hutman is a production designer, I believe.
Yeah. Interesting. He doesn't seem to have a very long... He has a remarkable CV as a production designer, not a long resume as far as directing. So I'd be curious to know if there's a little story behind it. And he seems to have done a very good job with it.
Yeah. Here's a little synopsis about the episode before we jump into our discussion. CJ learns that the House Speaker was asked, "Why do you want to be president?" And he blows the answer. Sam's battling Bruno and Connie on the issue of soft money and whether or not the re-election campaign should take advantage of it. The First Lady and Oliver Babish discuss how she's the biggest liability in Congress's investigation into the president's MS scandal. Toby debates the merits of the National Endowment of the Arts with an Appropriations Committee member who wants to eliminate its funding. And the president, Leo, Nancy, and Albie Duncan ponder what to do about a submarine that's incommunicado or gone quiet, just 2 miles from the coast of North Korea.
There it is. Not a lot of action on camera this episode.
But a lot of comedy.
Yes. Starting with CJ's singing and dancing.
I really think this is one of the funnier episodes that we've watched so far.
I'm going to disagree with you on that because I think there's a comic subplot that I don't love, but we'll get to shortly. Although I do love singing, dancing CJ and that whole thread, and that's the soundtrack to her gloating over the over that poor answer to the question. And I also love that we get a really meaty carol scene.
Yeah.
Props to Melissa Fitz, who's terrific in that opening scene with CJ.
And I love the just the little dance that CJ does after Carol tells her that he's blown the answer.
Wait a second. Are you telling me he got the question?
It was a train wreck. I recognize all the words.
Give me the transcript.
Yeah.
She just stands in her office for a second and just does a little wiggle.
Yes. It's subtle and very, very funny.
It's a great
very
wiggle.
Allison. Yeah, it's a great moment.
The part that made me laugh the hardest at this episode is also a wordless moment. When Leo goes in to talk to the president about the submarine in very small, easy to understand words, like he is a child. At one point he says,
"Well, as you know, with our ships, our boats, and our submarines, we keep in pretty close touch with radar, sonar, satellites, radio."
As he's saying this, the president turns very slowly to Charlie and just gives him a look.
Yeah, no, not exactly what you're talking about, but this, alas, to me, is the comic subplot that doesn't work for me.
Oh my gosh. That look made me laugh.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the execution of all the moments. Here's what bothers me about it. I feel like President Bartlett has been recast as a buffoon, although we've seen his character develop from military dilettante, and
right.
You know, we've seen him go from feeling really out of his league when it comes to being in the sit room and having to make the kinds of decisions that he must as commander-in-chief, but we've seen him develop to the point where I can't believe Leo's talking to him like he's a baby. Like, it's funny,
right? No, I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah, that bugged me throughout, even though I get that on its terms this would be funny, but I feel like it's not really true to the Bartlett
right.
we've come to know.
Because they've developed this idea already dramatically in seasons past, and now they're returning to, they're like regressing just for the comedy.
Right, exactly. We're going to a little time machine so we can have one funny episode about how the president doesn't know anything about
right.
the military. And, you know, even to the point where in the sit room initially, when Leo is apprised of the situation by Nancy, she actually almost suggests that he not take it to the president because he's going to panic.
I've got to tell the president.
The president's going to hit the panic button, Leo. If the Portland went quiet, it's because somebody's sitting on top of him. These guys know what they're doing.
That's some very high stakes, the idea of actually keeping a piece of information this vital and this urgent from the commander-in-chief.
Well, that's the thing. Is it vital and is it urgent, or is it just a matter of course? That's, I think, what it hinges on. If it's not vital, then there's no reason to bring it to the president because it's just a thing that's going to happen.
Right, but I mean, something's going on. She's in the sit room and the NSC has been convened and it's important enough to tell Leo about.
Right.
And in other words, the President Bartlett we're suddenly presented with in this episode is someone you keep information from because you can't talk to him rationally and he's not going to look at the different options and you can't say to him, hey, the chances are that this submarine has gone quiet intentionally. And it's just, right. I don't buy that, President Bartlett.
I also wonder if there's a possibility where, like in the look that the president gives Charlie, I think part of it is an acknowledgement of the evolution that he has had, that he's like, I've been doing the job now for 2 years. I've gone through all of this stuff. This guy's still talking to me like I don't know anything. Like that regression.
And do you accept that as a Leo Bartlett relationship?
I mean, I totally understand why you say that. And I felt that too, where I was like, what happened to, you know, now I thought that the president was kind of cool with all of this stuff and cool with people's sense that he understands. But I also understood in my experience, I used to be late for things a lot when I was in like high school and college, so much so that it kind of became like a running thing with my friends. It was like, oh, Rishi's late, like big surprise. But I realized like what a terrible trait that was, like how annoying it must be for my friends. And I tried very hard to become punctual. And it's still something that I think about all the time, you know, and I try and be early to things. I try and overcompensate so that nobody has to criticize me for that thing again. But like for at least a couple years in there, when I really felt like I hadn't solved the issue and like made progress, there would be comments here and there. Or, you know, if I was like a couple, you know, it was hard to escape the reputation, even though my behavior had actually changed. And so I kind of buy the idea that like you can evolve past what people's image of you is.
Yeah. Well, so you're positing that it's really in the people surrounding Bartlett and their treatment of him. But my counter is that in that Oval Office scene with Leo and President Bartlett and Albie Duncan, I think the president is presented to us as a little bit of a buffoon.
And if they were in trouble, you see, they wouldn't send a distress signal because they might be detected. And submariners have a different set of criteria when assessing risk versus reward.
He knows.
Okay, I'll just stand over there.
So it's not just in the people surrounding him. I think we are given a President Bartlett that is too different from the President Bartlett we've come to know.
All right. Again, I don't know if this is just me. I'm an apologist for all of these things or that I've drunk the Kool-Aid.
You're a subject of the Kool-Aid.
Exactly. I am have been subject of the Kool-Aid. I think, again, there it's more like the president is just on his heels a little bit because of the relationship, the dynamic that already exists between Albie Duncan and him.
He's going to scold me. He's been at the State Department since Truman, and he thinks I'm a kid and that he outranks me.
Albie Duncan will never take him seriously, so he takes every opportunity to try and assert any kind of authority, but he's just off his game because this guy intimidates him a little bit.
I don't subject myself of that Kool-Aid.
That's fine. That part where the president turns to Charlie in Leo's address, though, I almost wish instead of turning to Charlie, he just looked into the camera.
That I would have appreciated.
It reminds me of Trading Places, the Eddie Murphy movie. There's a moment in Trading Places where Eddie Murphy's character is getting an explanation of what commodities are. Do you know what part I'm talking
about? No, does he have a take to the camera?
Oh, yeah. They're like,
now, what are commodities? Commodities are agricultural products, like coffee that you had for breakfast, wheat, which is used to make bread, pork bellies, which is used to make bacon, which you might find in a bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwich.
And on that line, the BLT line, Eddie Murphy turns and looks right into the camera, like breaks the fourth wall. And it's my favorite part.
That's fantastic. I'm all for it. That's fun. I have to go back and watch them.
It's the best part of a great movie. But yeah, I was a little bit annoyed with Leo too, of like, come on. But it was funny. I thought it was funny.
Well, you were wrong.
I also thought Oliver and the First Lady, their whole exchange was funny. Even the way he says,
I read Le Monde. Was it in Le Monde?
I don't know. I don't read Le Monde.
Yes. There was kind of a dueling French accent aspect to that scene. I liked that. Yeah. I like his line about having been thrown out of bars before, too.
You should be careful, Oliver. You keep talking like a person, they're going to kick you out of the bar.
I've been kicked out of bars before.
I meant.
I know what you meant.
Oh, yeah. Clever. Yeah. I like their two-man show.
Yeah, no, I liked all their scenes together, too. It's an interesting question. I mean, did we know before this that she had written prescriptions for the president in her name?
I feel like that had come up. I
can't remember whether that had dropped yet.
I remember in season two, in 18th and Potomac, Oliver says to the First Lady,
yeah.
Then almost 4 years ago, you put him on interferon beta 1B.
Yeah.
Beta steron.
Yeah.
You did it, not Vikram.
It was in consultation with Vikram.
But Vikram didn't write the prescription.
I thought of the service.
But it didn't say she wrote them out in her, you know.
Right. They both, I think, kind of make light of it as if to say the public may not be so upset about that as the man who breaks the window to, you know, get the prescription that his wife needs. But we're talking about a doctor prescribing pills or medicine in her name for her husband, the president. I don't know. It just struck me as like, this is serious. This is very serious. She is in hot water. And I like that they're sort of uniting in their attempt to fight the idea of criminalizing her behavior as a way to get at the president.
Right.
Which she can't otherwise do. Although at the same time, I was thinking she probably deserves some sort of consequences for the actions she's taken.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the end, it's almost like Oliver's arguing against it. And Abigail is saying no.
Yeah. And here's some consequences I can offer them. In a deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. There's an interesting subtle shift in positions.
Yeah. There's one weird thing that Oliver says. He says,
you're not a medical expert. You didn't keep records. You violated medical practices in three states. And most important, you're his wife, which is a violation of the AMA's code of ethics.
I get the last ones, but the first one he says, you're not a medical expert.
Oh, yeah. I bumped on that too.
Yeah, but maybe he meant she's not a medical expert in the area of MS, but it seemed like a strange line.
Yeah, no, I expected her to say, well, slow down. You know I'm a doctor.
Right, we started this, remember at the beginning of the scene when we talked about how I'm a medical expert?
Yeah, no, I thought that was odd as well.
Yeah. There was another little line that was kind of strange, but there was an exchange between Sam and Bruno when they're talking about soft money stuff. And I understood what he was saying, but the way that the exchange was constructed, it had a funny antecedent.
How can the president be opposed to soft money 1 year and then take it the next? Where's he going to be on campaign finance reform tomorrow?
Exactly where he is today, leading the charge against it.
I'm fairly certain what Bruno meant was leading the charge against soft money, but the sentence right before was, but what he's actually responding to is, where's he going to be on campaign finance? And it sounds like Bruno's saying he's leading the charge against campaign finance reform, which he's not.
You're right. I also had a moment trying to reconcile that. Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
He's responding to the second to last sentence that Sam said.
Yeah.
But there's a question in the last sentence. And when he answers that, it sounds like it's the opposite of what he means.
Which I guess people do.
Sure.
I mean, people do speak that way. But you're right. I also had a moment there where I thought, is that what he means?
Yeah. I mean, we misspeak all the time. But hey, they say, if you have a glass house, you know better than anyone how effective a stone can be. I misspoke even there.
Boom.
This episode is the source of maybe the most reused, reusable, perennial, evergreen gif from the West Wing, which is the president banging his head against the desk.
Oh, yes. That's a funny moment.
I feel like more people have seen that gif than have seen the West Wing.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the gif. I would not have been able to tell you it was from this episode.
Yeah.
Now I know.
Should we talk about the Trump elephant in the room?
Well, there were a couple, but go for it, yes.
For me, the big one was the NEA.
Yeah, for me, it was the NEA and also the idea of diplomacy with regard to North Korea.
Right, of course.
There were definitely some two major Trump III plots going. Yeah,
the North Korean diplomacy one, of course. But even the fact that there was 1 degree or half a degree of separation, I wasn't thinking about it because it was so eclipsed for me by the 100% correlation of elimination of the NEA budget. But
before we dig into that, did you spot the Rishikesh III moment?
Well, no.
For me, that was that was Toby saying,
by and large, I'm not wild about musicals.
Is that a Rishi III or is that more of like a Rishi?
Whenever I contemplate your distaste for the American musical theater genre, I have a Rishi III moment.
Oh, but see, people listening to this right now are having a Josh III, I believe, because they will say that, because this has been said to me in criticism of my stance, musical theater is not a genre, it is a medium.
Musical theater is not, American musical theater isn't a genre?
I guess so, yeah. This is a position that has been articulated to me, that there's a sense that just having songs in a play that are sung on stage is not a genre because it's such a diverse medium.
All right. My head hurts too much to count. I'm just gonna relent on that. I guess I'm going to assume I'm wrong.
But I think the thing that I dislike is the genre.
I have to look up what genre means.
I think the genre is the thing that I object to. The everybody sing a dance. Sing a dance? What is or like the feeling of like, I don't know. What's my scene? Give me a setup here, Josh.
What do you mean?
I'm going to improvise a musical here for you.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Give me a scenario.
Two podcast hosts disagree strenuously about an episode.
All right. So then, you know, Josh, sometimes when I think about why I dislike musicals, I have to say, this is so stupid, and I'm gonna sing like this and do jazz hands.
I totally get it, because sometimes your emotions are too big for speaking. Sometimes.
What did you say? Did you say your emotions are
too big for merely speaking?
Oh, okay,
that's my rock opera version of that's what. Do you not like opera? Some emotions, some situations are beyond the spoken word. We have to go to that other ineffable part of our brains that wants to express itself in song.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a writer of songs. I totally agree with that.
I know. That's one thing that always kills me is that I love the 1AM radio. I love your work. I love your voice. I love the songs that you write. And you said to yourself at some point, I'm going to sit down and express what it's like to come across a photograph of an old lover. And I'm not going to write a poem about it, I am going to write a poem about it. But rather than reading that to the public, I feel like I have to set it to music and sing it. An old photo of your new lover that you discovered in a book she lent. And then there's this brilliant song as a result. But you don't like the mixture of the two.
No. That's why I think that my objection really is the genre. I think that there is a genre of musical theater, like the way the actual music sounds, like the melodic choices, the rhythmic choices, the performance choices, and that's what really gets on my nerves. Less the idea that someone's on a stage and they're speaking and then suddenly they bust into song. Because there are plenty of examples of things where I actually enjoy that, specific examples. But like the music in Chicago, the music in Cats, I think that a lot of that stuff feels schmaltzy to me in a way that doesn't have the emotional resonance that I think it's supposed to. It doesn't connect with me.
All you're saying is you don't like what you find to be bad musical theater.
Right.
But I don't get that from you. I get that you don't like musical theater. Or you just feel like 99% of what you're exposed to.
It is not a categorical dislike. It's just that there are so many specific examples that I dislike that it's easier to say I don't like the genre or the medium or whatever.
Wow, this makes me actually want to pursue next what we've joked about, which is a podcast called Rishi Ruins a Musical. And maybe I could expose you. I mean, I think we'd go from millions of downloads a month to somewhere between 100 and 400, but but nonetheless, it might be a worthwhile. I want to take you to musical theater and find what it is you like.
Yeah, I am absolutely open to the idea that there are musicals out there that I would like because I like the songs. I mean, there are musicals out there that I like because I like the songs.
Right, but it's got to be beyond that. You know, that's the cast album is one thing, and then sitting and watching the scenes in between that lead to the songs and getting the book and the full experience is another. I mean, that's, I'm curious. Like, I'm guessing you don't like the original cast album of Cats.
I've never listened to it.
Okay.
I just, you know.
Is there a cast album that you like and then you've seen a production of this? The truth is you haven't seen a lot of musical theater, right?
No, not at all.
I think we got to do it.
I'm open to going. It's just that sometimes you're like Rent, for example.
Mm-hmm.
People love Rent. It's not for me.
You know what? I didn't like Rent.
Yeah.
I've never felt older and more like a Republican than I went to see Rent. And I like a lot of the songs in it.
525,600 minutes.
I get tingles. I brings tears to my eyes. When I saw the actual show, I was like, ugh, these dirty kids, go get a real job and actually rent a place, you and your squatting. So that didn't appeal to me.
I mean, I haven't actually seen it. See, this is the thing is, I'm saying it's not for me, but I haven't seen it. The reason why I didn't watch it is because the songs. I like heard one song and I was like, whew, this is just so cheesy.
Do you not like Seasons of Love?
I don't know if I know that one.
Ah, oh, come on. Oh, you're going to have to, I want you to listen to it.
I think my way in is going to be, it might have to be that like, I have to love a song first from it before I agree to watch it. I don't know. I'm open to it.
All right.
I'm open to it. But I'm just saying that there are very few exceptions where there's a musical that I really enjoy. But they definitely exist.
How many musicals have you seen in your life?
You mean like on stage in a theater setting?
No. I mean at home in your closet. What, do you know what a musical is? And do you know what seeing a musical means?
Most of my experience with musicals is film adaptations, movie musicals.
Okay, that's very different. That may be, I'm not sure. That's either a genre or I don't know what that is anymore. I've lost the command of English. But yeah, okay, movie musicals, very different. And I would argue that while there are some brilliant ones, Cabaret comes to mind, it is difficult to adapt a great stage musical to film. Not that
right.
It's been done many times, but there are lots of disappointing movie musicals.
Right. So maybe a huge asterisk needs to be placed next to every statement I say about musicals, because these are opinions formed by movies.
Yeah, well, I would bet so. I mean, to me, look, a close-up of somebody breaking into song, I think, feels very different to me from sitting in a theater, hearing the person actually vocalize, and also having a little bit of distance from them. Like, it's a big thing.
Yeah.
And it looks sometimes over the top in a movie in a way where it feels more organic, I think, often live.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in the orchestra pit for two musicals.
Which were those?
Hair.
Mm-hmm.
At Yale.
Oh.
And Star Mites at the Higgins Middle School in Peabody, Massachusetts.
Hair at Yale with nudity? Wow. If it's this long a pause, I hope the answer is no, there was no nudity.
I don't remember. I don't remember. I was backstage. I never saw it.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought you were in the pit. I thought you could just look up.
I mean,
which might have been too graphic.
It wasn't that kind of pit.
Boom. Okay. And were you a fan of either of those shows?
I think the music in Hair is quite good.
You know what? I think Hair is a pretty good movie musical. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
You should.
Okay.
All right. Well, that was a good... I want more people to weigh in. I think we should put together...
No, please. Don't at me with your musical opinions.
Okay, well, on the website, let's put together a list of shows that I should take Rishi to for Rishi Ruins Musical. I'm going to see Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway in a week. Very excited. Mm. Have you heard of it?
I have not.
Ah, Tony nominated. I'm going to see Ben Platt and the others from the original cast, and I'm very, very, very excited.
Awesome. How about Dear Evan Handler? Why aren't you in this episode?
You know what? I have referred to that musical as Dear Evan Handler like 9 times because I've got my wires crossed.
Where is Doug in this episode? We've got Bruno and Connie, but...
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. My guess is he was working on something else.
He had a job?
Yeah, probably. Dear Evan Handler might have been playing Dr. Crazy in the Dr. Crazy episode of Ed. When this filmed, because that is his only other Oh, no, he also played Shrug in It's Like You Know, the TV series up to 2000. No, I'm going to guess that this week he was shooting an episode of Ed.
Hmm. Back to the NEA?
Yes, back to the NEA.
Slut is a one-word poem by Jules Waltz. It's stamped in scarlet on a piece of 40 by 40 black canvas. Here's a woman who gets naked, covers herself completely in chocolate, and sings. Does that appeal to you?
So Trump, Trump would like to, in fact, do away with the NEA, but thus far he has failed to do so, as the budget that was just recently passed includes funding.
True.
Which is the good news.
Do you know what the numbers were in the budget?
I believe it said the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, are each being funded through September to the tune of $150 million a year each. Which, when you consider that we are a country of 300 million plus people, is not a lot of money.
Yes. Here's something about the NEA that I think is interesting. You know, like, it's an example of federal funding where it gets distributed to states, and the NEA doesn't actually tell the states what they have to do. For proponents of states' rights, you know, this is an example where, like, the money comes from the government, but then the states get to decide how they want to distribute it. People in California might have different things that they want to fund than the state government in Kentucky, and it is up to the state to do that. There's a sense, I think, of that the NEA is Washington, D.C., giving out money to objectionable creative pursuits, but it's actually not, that's not actually how the mechanism
right.
works.
Go lobby your state about what kind of art you want the money to go to, rather than perhaps arguing against money going to the arts.
Yeah. I found an article in the Post that said, although all states would suffer under the proposed budget, this is back from March when Trump was trying to cut the NEA budget, although all the states would suffer under the proposed budget, poor and rural communities would be hardest hit, according to the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies, because about 25% of NEA funds go to rural communities and 54% go to low-income areas.
Right. That's what I think that is another misapprehension about the NEA is that it's taxpayer money going to fund artistic atrocities for rich people. And in fact, it gets art into the inner cities and into rural areas.
Yeah. Now maybe it's moot because we know what the budget actually turned out to be, but I'll put a link to that Post article on the site.
Sure. It's also, you know, that always gets off the, I wanted to hear the argument here from Aaron because he would articulate it so well about what the arts do for, you know, kids and adults going into STEM areas and, you know, and science and math. And, you know, there's all kinds of research to suggest that the opening up of one's creativity in an artistic area nourishes the other parts of your brain and
right.
your thought processes in other endeavors.
Right. Creativity is such a huge part of engineering and science and being able to think critically and to imagine that you could get rid of one and still have the others exist as richly. I mean, it's the whole, it undermines the entire notion of a liberal arts education.
Indeed. It was fun to observe Aaron having fun creating artistic projects for this woman to complain about. One of them involving Rottweiler dung.
Hold the lettuce. Lydia Benedict's two bacon cheeseburgers were constructed from pieces of burlap and Rottweiler dung.
Right. Which I thought was funny.
But so you wanted Aaron to articulate that more beyond Toby's line.
There is a connection between the progress of a society and progress in the arts. The age of Pericles was also the age of Phidias. The age of Lorenzo de' Medici was also the age of Leonardo da Vinci. The age of Elizabeth was the age of Shakespeare.
Yes, but Toby of all people with this stuff just ready to go. I was like, really?
This is interesting. That line of Toby's is actually a quote from JFK.
I did not know that.
Yeah, this is a letter that JFK wrote to the publisher of Musical America in 1960. And the line from that letter is, there is a connection, hard to explain logically, but easy to feel, between achievement in public life and progress in the arts. The age of Pericles was also the age of Phidias. The age of Lorenzo de' Medici was also the age of Leonardo da Vinci. The age of Elizabeth, also the age of Shakespeare. And the new frontier for which I campaign in public life can also be a new frontier for American art. So, you know, that middle section is lifted directly from that letter and put into Toby's dialogue.
Interesting. How did you come upon that?
I Google frequently while I'm watching the show. There are things where I'm like, oh, what do I want to know more about this. And
by the way, just your mention of the phrase New Frontier just reminds me of the great Donald Fagen song, New Frontier, which phrase he stole from Kennedy.
Oh, really?
He was survival on the New Frontier.
from the album The Nightfly.
He stole that from Kennedy.
I believe so. I've always cool. assumed so.
Well, New Frontier reminds me of The Final Frontier.
Which you stole from Star Trek.
This is my segue into the Star Trek. There is a deep Star Trek reference in this episode. Again, this is something I don't actually know about because I don't know Star Trek very well, but I discovered through research for this episode while just like Googling different things. You know, when it turns out that the Portland has gone quiet, when they get communication back up from them, you hear the Portland say,
"Went deep and quiet to avoid close aboard contact with Ludacris Destroyer."
Yes. Is that something from Star Trek?
That's from Star Trek. These like science Starfleet ships.
That's fantastic. I wonder if that's somebody on Aaron's staff. I don't think he's a big Trekkie, Aaron, is he?
I don't know, but somebody
slipped that in.
And I thought that was a great, very subtle reference. It made me want to bring up something that we have not talked about, but I think is also a really cool Easter egg going the other way around. Do you know about on Star Trek Voyager, there's a great West Wing Easter egg?
Oh, where they list the names of the crew?
Yes, as people who have died. There's a graphic in the background of deceased crew members. And
I think people have tweeted that photo to me. It's fantastic. It's yeah. all West Wing staff members. Did they misspell Bartlett? I feel like there may be. I've noticed that too. I've got to look at it again now.
They do. They spell Bartlett with three T's instead of two.
Boom.
But it's yeah, Commander J. Bartlett, Lieutenant Commander L. McGarry, Lieutenant Commander T. Ziegler.
Fantastic.
And so I found an article about this with an interview from the graphic art supervisor on Slate. Mike Okuda, who's the graphic art supervisor, said, "Some of us in the art department were big West Wing fans. We used to joke that the West Wing, with its close-knit family of characters on an idealistic mission, should have been a Star Trek spinoff."
Huh.
However, one of my rules regarding jokes was that they should never be apparent to the casual viewer. If they were, they would yank the viewer out of the story, and that would be a serious disservice to both. For this reason, I generally try to keep the text on such gags at the ragged edge of legibility.
That's great.
That text went by on the screen pretty quickly and was thus unlikely to catch the viewer's eye. So in a similar vein, this Luna class thing is not something that you would ever pay attention to, but if somebody happened to know, they could get a little extra giggle from it.
That's fantastic. Do you know when that the crew member thing happened on Voyager? What would the time frame be? There's no way this is a response to that.
It was from the episode Imperfection of Voyager, which came before. It's from October 2000.
So this could be a response.
It could be.
I think we've discovered something. I think it was a little nod back to the Voyager people from
back to the,
the West Wing writers.
That would be great.
That would be great.
Yeah.
By the way, did you point out that phrase New Frontier was used by JFK in his 1960 presidential acceptance speech?
No, I did not.
"And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The frontier of the 1960s. The frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. The frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats."
Okay, so that's where it's from. And we'll link to it because I do love that Donald Fagen song, which kind of riffs on the whole idea of the 60s being the new frontier. And there's reference to bomb shelters. And it's a great, great song.
Yeah. I'm going to now use this opportunity to go from another Star Trek West Wing crossover, Al Kiefer.
Yes.
Who played Q.
Q, right.
Al Kiefer, you know, I remember in Mandatory Minimums, Sam called him
Mr. Good News, Happy Guy.
Oh, right.
And then in this episode, the president calls Albie Duncan
Mr. Happy Fun Guy.
That's right. I like how they're lit. I like when they remove themselves from the Oval Office, Leo and President Bartlett, and they have a little discussion just in the doorway, and they're barely lit. They're almost like in the dark. It's just kind of, I don't know, I like the lighting choice there.
Yeah. It was delightful.
Boom.
Josh, do you watch Last Man on Earth?
Oh, do I love that show.
I was thinking about it because when...
Because I say boom a lot.
You tweeted... You say boom a lot, but when you tweeted the other day, someone was like, "Well, I hope Josh Molina writes my obituary for me," and you wrote, "She dead."
Does that feel like a Last Man on Earth?
Do you remember that? Like, that's what Will Forte will often say.
"He dead."
"He dead." Oh, then I'm sure it was a subconscious steal from Will Forte.
Oh, okay.
Because I love, love, love that show. And I think that's why I say boom a lot now.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good.
Interesting. I don't know. Would I have predicted that would be a Rishi favorite? I don't know. You're hard to pin down. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
You're a complicated, layered man. Yeah, I love that show. And I think it's underrated.
I think so too. I only recently got into it.
As long as we're not just randomly talking about TV, do you watch Catastrophe?
I just finished the third season on Friday. I watched the entire, I watched two episodes one night and then like watched four episodes on Friday night.
Yeah, I sick binged it too, to the point where I'm mad at myself because now I probably have to wait a year to see the next.
Exactly.
How great is it?
It's so great. And both of these shows are shows that I've watched entire, like every episode of this year.
Mm-hmm.
I only got into Last Man on Earth a few, you know, maybe a month ago.
Oh, I love that show. But I am blown away by Catastrophe and by how good it is and how each subsequent season seems to get richer and deeper without losing any of the funny. And oh, is it well done? Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney. Hat tip to them both. And I think it is, although the critics have lavished great praise on it, I think it is underwatched. And I really strongly recommend that everybody listening right now go and watch, if you haven't, watch the first season. It will hook you.
Yeah, it's great.
What say we take a quick break and come back later?
And now back to the show.
All right, back to the episode. This is what I wanted to say. Did the House Majority Leader's response to what I consider a fairly softball question for someone considering running for the office of president in the United States, his response is very funny that CJ reads back.
The reason I would run were I to run is I have a great belief in this country as a country and in this people as a people that go into making this country a nation with the greatest natural resources and population of people, educated people.
It put me in mind of, I'm sure you've seen this, the classic misfire of a Miss Teen USA contestant.
Oh, Miss South Carolina, yeah, right?
Miss South Carolina, very good.
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
I thought, well, this is actually disturbingly similar. It's just complete incoherence.
I would love it if someone would cut together a video of the actual majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, if they could find enough speeches of his where they could cut together a montage of him delivering Miss South Carolina's answer. That would be hilarious. And I will send you a lapel pin if you do it.
Nice. Make it so.
Oh, speaking of what, of Star Trek.
Right. I can play the game. A little bit. I love the also, just to get back to the NEA scene, I like when Sam walks in.
You funded his performance piece recently, which involved him destroying all his belongings outside of Starbucks in Haight-Ashbury.
I've done that a couple of times, but I didn't know there was funding available.
It's a very, very funny couple of lines and very well delivered by Rob Lowe.
Yep. I was just writing down all of the moments that made me chuckle. Like the look from the president made me laugh so hard. It made me cackle full on, but that I didn't know there was funding. I had written down as a line that made me laugh. Also, Nancy telling Leo to settle down at the beginning.
When's that day gonna come, Nancy? When's that gonna happen?
Settle down.
I tiffled more than a couple times this episode.
Another one I had written down was when the president, again, just desperate for having any kind of authority at all in the room, when Albie Duncan says, cause a spell eye. And he jumps in and says to Leo,
you've got causes, Belli?
Cause for war. Little thing called Latin.
Yes.
Again, could have been a line from Will Forte in Last Man on
That's true. Little thing called Latin. Boom.
Boom.
Right. Is that how it's pronounced? Is it not casus belli? I did write that down, but I haven't bothered to Google it.
I think that you can say belli instead of belly, but there's no U. It's not like, it's not causus. It's Cassis.
Did you ever take Latin?
I never took Latin, so I don't actually know what I'm talking about. But, you know, it's never stopped us before.
No, exactly. Are you kidding? You have to go back and redo every episode if that's the criterion. I wish I had taken it in high school. It was offered at my high school. I'm sure it was at yours as well, because you went to a swanky boarding school. And I regret it. I regret not taking Latin.
I regret so many things I could have done if I'd paid more attention in school.
Do you? I'm delighted to hear that.
Yeah.
I hate when people say, I have no regrets. I was like, how's that possible? But in that scene, however it's pronounced, that was my second Trump I moment.
The casus belli.
Yes, appreciating that Albie Duncan, Leo, and the president would be concerned with the potential provocation of North Korea when our own president, Donald Trump, has recently said things like, if China is not going to solve North Korea, we will. And North Korea is a problem. The problem will be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And then not long after suggesting that he'd be also happy to welcome Kim Jong-un to the White House.
I mean, again, it goes to that question that we asked Ambassador Pressman. Is it crazy to invite your potential enemies to the White House? I thought maybe that's a good idea, you know, like sit down with Kim Jong-un and sit down with someone like Duterte and try and reason with them. Say, you're my guys and there's nothing I wouldn't do for you.
That is funny.
I also laughed at the exchange between Josh and the president where he says,
why do you want to be president? I don't. Well, we'll put that in the hopper and show you a draft. Good.
Do you have any question as to whether the president could, off the top of his head, come up with a rather eloquent and moving response? The idea that they're sitting and trying to compose a decent Bartlett response to that query seemed odd to me.
Yeah. I imagined that they would do something where they throw a bunch of stuff at him and then he would
just crush it off the top of his head, extemporaneously crush that one out of the park.
Yeah. Although I think if the idea is to have a succinct answer, he might have some trouble.
That's true. Yeah, right. Yeah. Give me the two-line version.
Yeah.
We haven't discussed Gail's fishbowl in quite a while. We've found meatier ways into most of these episodes, but...
Yeah, much like Armageddon, we have found meatier ways in.
Wow. That's good. That is funny. That is clever. If I were an average person, I would be laughing out loud. Props on the stunning speed of that joke.
But there is one. There is a fishbowl moment here, right?
Yes. Well, there is a Bartlett campaign button in Gail's fishbowl this episode. But you got to wonder, no submarine?
Right. I mean,
come on.
Maybe it's too easy.
I guess perhaps it was too on the nose.
Mm-hmm. Do you call the front of a submarine the nose?
I was just trying to think of a goldfish nose, what you call that. Now it's basically this podcast is degenerated into a race to the nearest dad joke.
Like a submarine, we're going as quickly as we can to the bottom.
Oh, dear.
Don't submarines have noses? Have I seen too many Pixar movies?
You know, I don't know. Do goldfish have noses?
Snouts?
Snout, perhaps.
Fish nose is quite the delicacy, I hear. Actually, it's on the new Blue Apron. Fish nose with rigatoni and pumpkin balls.
Fallina palata. What is it called?
What was it again? Fontina panini.
Yes, a fish nose fontina panini. Or paninas, I think is the singular.
But yeah, there was a campaign button. In War Crimes, there was another Gail's fishbowl moment. There were American flags in the fishbowl, perhaps for the International War Crimes Tribunal.
Sure.
Maybe. Or maybe that was just a generic gimme. But yeah, but there's a Bartlett campaign button. And it brings me to the question that I had about the campaign work that was being done in the White House in this episode.
Which we have not discussed yet, really.
No, yeah. Sam and Bruno and Connie have this meeting about soft money. And I was wondering about the ethics of that, or maybe even the legality of that, about, you know, a staffer working for the campaign. You know, Jim Messina, who was deputy chief of staff, right?
This was before he hooked up with Kenny Loggins.
Jim Messina was the deputy chief of staff under Obama, and then he left to run the 2012 re-election campaign. But he stepped down from his position. And there was some stuff around that time about, and I think the headquarters were in Chicago, but there's obviously a division of people working on the re-election campaign in the White House itself. Right. There's an article in Politico about this called Campaigning from the White House. And there was this quote, "No laws prohibit the president or senior West Wing officials from engaging in electoral activity during their day jobs. Although the 1930s era Hatch Act prohibits them from using government resources to do so or to fundraise in U.S. government offices. Most federal workers, including White House staff, are permitted to politic during their off hours, but not while at work."
I could be arguing in my spare time.
Right. I was wondering if that, so Sam kind of splitting his time doing both, if that was
kosher.
Yeah, if that was in a murky, not necessarily kosher area.
I'm not sure I bought that Toby's idea was revelatory, that rather than do an end run around the prohibition for a candidate spot by avoiding the magic words, that we actually make issues ads. You know, it's kind of like, that didn't occur to you guys in the room earlier. Like, we're allowed to make issue ads. Why don't we make issue ads?
Yeah. I guess maybe because of the response of the soft money that was actually going directly after the president, putting his face on there with a red X on it.
Right. That they felt the natural response would be put him out in a positive light. I guess
right.
So.
That was one where I'm like, it's a TV show.
Yeah, fair enough.
Explain it to me. I know this goes back to the comic subplot that you did not like, but I did chuckle at Leo saying,
"The USS Portland is a Seawolf class or a big nuclear submarine."
Nothing for you.
Well, no, it was, I had to wear two different hats.
Yeah.
Funny within this new world they proposed for this single episode, but problematic to me as an overall West Wing viewer.
Yeah. There's one moment, one directorial moment that I liked, which was at the end of Leo's first scene in the sit room. He walks out and the camera's following him, tracking to the right. And it transitions, it dissolves from that to outside of the Oval Office. And the camera continues moving at sort of a similar pace and then stops on the president looking out the window to the helicopter. And I just thought that was a nice, beautiful visual move.
I agree.
When the president says to Charlie,
"You're pretty mouthy today."
I thought that was true for the whole episode.
Charlie himself?
Like the whole episode of The West Wing itself was
mouthy.
Mouthy.
You're mouthy. Yeah, you're right.
I'd seen a quote from Dee Dee Myers saying that she always had objections for Aaron whenever people who would work for the president would kind of take those kinds of liberties. She felt like that was not realistic. And there are lines that you don't cross, and that kind of dynamic, as entertaining as I found it and as heartwarming as I find it, she was like, that doesn't really happen.
That's intriguing. And I think The West Wing, the television show, would be quite the less for it if they removed that kind of interaction between Bartlett and his staff.
Yeah. The First Lady is wheelchair bound in this episode.
Correct.
That's because Stockard Channing really did injure her foot.
Oh, interesting.
We didn't really talk about Hal Holbrook as Albie Duncan.
As Mark Twain. Hal Holbrook, for some reason, well, not for some reason, Hal Holbrook spent much of his life playing Mark Twain and doing a one-man show. And every time I see him, no matter what role he's playing, he's a terrific actor, I just think, it's Mark Twain.
Well, there's another little Easter egg in this episode, little inside joke.
1968. The USS Pueblo is on intelligence mission off the DPRK. North Korea attacks with vessels and a MiG jet.
If you look on his IMDb, you will find a listing in 1973 for the TV movie Pueblo. He played the captain of the Pueblo.
In that movie?
Yeah, it's a movie about the USS Pueblo, the American spy ship captured by North Korea.
That's delightful.
So when he says, "I was there."
He was.
And he won an Emmy for it, I think.
That's great. I love that.
Yep. Also, apparently Aaron had posted at one point on Television Without Pity that if you ask most people around here, they'd tell you Gone Quiet was the weakest show we've done. It was the only episode that USA Today has liked this season. I'm mentioning this because of the very unscientific yardsticks by which we measure how much the public enjoyed a particular episode. Places Night 5 among the top 5 we've ever done. A lot of us agree, including me, I'm afraid. Does that make someone wrong for not liking it? Of course not.
Interesting. Was this Aaron posting as Benjamin or as Aaron Sorkin?
Yeah, as Benjamin.
Huh. Why was he making that point? In response to what?
I don't know.
Interesting. Well, I would award that title to Isaac and Ishmael, but I don't disagree that this is lesser West Wing. And for me, that's in large part because of the rejiggering of President Bartlett that I don't like.
Mm-hmm. If you're still with us, thanks for listening. Thanks for enduring. Thanks for trusting Captain Josh Molina. Thanks for trusting the crew, me, Rishi K. Shearway.
The West Wing Weekly was made with the help of Zach McNeese and Margaret Miller.
And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're at The West Wing Weekly on most of those places, except for Twitter, where we're at West Wing Weekly.
I like how we're not spoon-feeding people anymore.
No, they know.
You want to talk to us? You want to talk about us? You want to leave a comment? You got to do 4 seconds of research. Here's a link we will give you in its entirety. If you would like to support the endeavor that is The West Wing Weekly by purchasing some of our fine products designed by Rishikesh Hirway, you can go to thewestwingweekly.com/merch.
Buy a pin, post a picture, hashtag Bartlett's Army.
That's right.
I'm working on a Bartlett's Army t-shirt design.
Are you really? That's a great idea.
In my mind.
Fantastic. The West Wing Weekly is a proud member of Radiotopia, a curated selection of some of the finest podcasts to be had.
To learn more, go to radiotopia.fm. Okay.
Okay.
What's next? If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out Normal Gossip from Radiotopia. They're coming back for their 6th season. If you don't already know the show, they were named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, and their new season starts April 17th. Normal Gossip is really fun. It's a show about petty and ridiculous and strange stories and the way that we share those stories. The stories that they tell in the podcast are sent in by listeners, and then they're anonymized and then retold to a guest. And then they have to weigh in on the decisions that the people in the story are making. It's very funny and very beloved. So if you aren't already listening, check out the new season, which starts April 17th. You can listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia.